Soulful. Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo, and today I have a recent Firebird Book Award winning author to share with you. He is S.P. Somtow. Born in Bangkok, Somtow grew up in Europe and was educated at Eton and Cambridge. His first career was in music, and in the 1970s, he acquired a reputation as a revolutionary composer, the first to combine Thai and Western instruments in radical new sonorities. Conditions in the arts in the region at the time proved so traumatic for this young composer that he suffered a major burnout, emigrated to the United States, and reinvented himself as a novelist. His earliest novels were in the science fiction field, but he soon began to cross into other genres. In his 1984 novel Vampire Junction, he injected a new literary inventiveness into the horror genre. After becoming a Buddhist monk for a period in 2001, he decided to refocus his attention on the country of his birth, founding Bangkok's first international opera company, and returning to music, where he once again reinvented himself, this time as a neo-Asian, neo-romantic composer. According to London's Opera Magazine, in just 5 years, Somtow has made Bangkok into the operatic hub of Southeast Asia. His current project, the Siam Sinfonietta, is a youth orchestra he founded 5 years ago, using a new educational method he pioneered and which is now among the most acclaimed youth orchestras worldwide. Well, as you can see, there is just way too much to find out about this exciting Somtow, so I'm just going to say welcome to the network.
Well, hi. Hi there. Yeah, well, you already know everything, so I barely have to talk now.
Oh, no, I have lots to dig into. Gosh, this is such an honor for me. It's midnight. You're in Bangkok, right?
Yes, I'm in Bangkok. Yeah. It's midnight. I just got back from my sister's birthday party, in fact.
So here we are, midnight in Bangkok, having this glorious conversation. Congratulations to you on winning the International Firebird Book Award for a couple of books you submitted, Homeworld of the Heart, Phoenix, and the most recent Club X, Vampire in the Closet. So congratulations from our end.
Well, I want to thank you for running a very interesting program and probably introducing many books to people which otherwise would not be noticed. I mean, I think that what you're doing is really wonderful.
Thank you. You're no stranger to awards.
Yeah, I have won a few awards, but the fact that it's called the Firebird Award is very sort of thrilling to me. Almost titillating in a way, because you know I'm very sort of close to Phoenixes.
I know you are, and we're going to talk about that book. I just love you. You know, I first became familiar with you via you and your music and your youth orchestra. I found all of that online through Instagram and immediately was attracted to you. I'd studied music in the past, but never quite to the extent that you have. But
you love the Firebird, right?
I do.
I mean, that's one of your favorite pieces of music, I think.
It absolutely is. But I'm very fascinated. Can you just tell us briefly, maybe, about your work with youth and this new educational method? What was it? Because obviously it works extremely well. That group is stunning.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they hear this orchestra play, they don't actually realize that it's a bunch of kids, mm-hmm. you know. One of the things about it is that I never tell them what they cannot do. I only talk about what they can do, right? I mean, the whole system that I've been using is about answering the question, why? Let me explain. When I first came back to Thailand, I had one traumatic experience trying to do what young men do, you know, which is like they think they have to revolutionize all art they have these grand ideas and it didn't go down very well here. But I was driven out by harsh critics and so on, and ran away to America, right? And then for about 20 years, I didn't do music at all. I completely gave up and became a novelist. And I didn't think I was ever going to come back to Thailand. But then about 25 years ago, I did. And it was just like a one-off. I had been commissioned to compose an opera in which was going to the funds raised by this performance were going to be used for the reconstruction of an ancient palace. So it was a very interesting cause, a very exciting project. And I had been completely out of music for some time, except sort of slowly dabbling in it again. And what happened was that when I got here and we did this production, that it seemed to me that there was an incredible thirst for something new, and that it was very exciting to work here in ways that I had never imagined. So I ended up abandoning a relatively cushy existence in California and coming back to Thailand. And the last 25 years has been a wild struggle in many ways. And yet it's been really deeply rewarding. But your question was about the youth orchestra, which came about 10 years after I had been working here. What happened was that, and what's different about it, is most youth orchestras are founded by a municipality or a college or a conservatory, and they're founded from the top down. I mean, somebody up there says, I think I'll have a youth program, right? And then they find funding and they set it up and so on. And what happened in my case was quite different. It was just a bunch of teenagers who were very fine musicians came to me and said, you know, we want to play real music because we have they're very talented musicians there, but the way they were being taught music was that they would play like a bit of this and a bit of that. They'd play one movement of something and another movement of something else because this was how it was being taught. In other words, they were being taught to dabble, and when they watched concerts in Europe on YouTube, they could see people playing music all the way through, like every movement of a symphony, something like that, right? And they said, we want to play real music like that. And basically, this orchestra started in a dentist's office. Oh. I had a friend who was a dentist. He's like the dentist to the stars in Bangkok. So this office was like a very palatial. It actually had a room big enough for an orchestra to rehearse in, right?
Wow.
So these kids got some friends, and I started to experiment in how to teach music to these people because, first, the quality of music teaching is quite high, and there are actually 5 music colleges in Bangkok. And I realized that I needed to give them something that they weren't getting anywhere else. So I decided to I realized that music teaching here was really good at teaching you how to do things, you know, how to play in tune, how to play those difficult passages, what fingering to you, that kind of thing, you know, how to make a beautiful sound. But they were not getting many answers to the question, why? And why is the most fundamental question in all art, really.
Right.
How is just sort of the way you get to answering why, right?
Yes.
So basically, I started an orchestra, and I completely eschewed the idea of how. I didn't want to teach them technically how to do things. I would expect them to take it to their really fine teacher, and their really fine teacher would say, this is how you say this. And what I would do is get to the roots of it. I would get to, like, what was going on in that period in history, what that composer must have been going through, what that milieu was like, what the philosophy was like. I would get into those things, and I would try to make them play it as though they were living in that, they were living that life, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think it gave the kids an edge, you see. So after a couple of years, I thought, well, I'll enter them into a competition in Europe, because so that they can see how good they really are. And we did something that required great chutzpah, because we played in a competition in Vienna at the Musikverein, which is, you know, where people like Brahms, you know, first conducted or something. It's like really historical place. And one of the pieces of music we played was my reconstruction of a movement of Mahler's 10th Symphony from his pencil sketches, because it was left unfinished. So we were in Austria playing Austrian music to a panel of all us Austrian judges, right? So either we were going to like be kicked out of the country for daring to, or we were going to get the first prize. There was like no, there was really nothing in between. You see, now luckily they did in fact win the first prize. So, and that sort of completely changed the way these young musicians saw themselves, and also the way that young musicians from this part of Asia were seen by Europeans. Mm-hmm. You see,
yes.
Because of that, I can tell you a little story about the method that I used. You see, because the opening of Mahler's First Symphony, which we did play in Europe on a different tour, it opens with a 7-octave unison from the highest note to the lowest note of the orchestra. The highest octave, the whole orchestra plays this one note in unison, and then slowly some other sounds begin to emerge from it. It's very mysterious. And it's like nothing you've ever heard, this sound, right? Mm-hmm. And Mahler's written in the instructions at the beginning, via Naturlaut, which is like a sound of nature. So we had the opportunity to go to the town where Mahler was born. And I took the orchestra there. And there's the forest that Mahler used to run around in as a child.
Wow.
And I said, Mahler, if you can hear this forest, then you can play this music. But this is what Mahler heard. This is what he reproduced.
Mm.
Right. So this was the edge that I think this method gave them, mm-hmm. that they were not getting elsewhere. And so the orchestra just became amazing. And soon they were doing pieces that the grown-up orchestras in Bangkok were not attempting. They've in fact done all the Mahler symphonies. They've done pieces like the Rite of Spring. Mm-hmm. Just recently they've done Petrushka. They haven't done the Firebird, oddly enough, we're going to do it soon in your honor, you know.
I'm so fascinated by this. I mean, you have taken them from just the mechanics of learning how to play an instrument way beyond that, to immerse them and submerge them in the history and the almost the psyche of the composer.
That's what you need to do in order to play music and not just play all the notes.
Right.
Because the music, not just the written notes. I mean, the written notes are just sort of the, it's like the combination of the safe, but it's not what's in the safe.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so true. That's a great way to put that. You know,
it's
so sad in a way that art can be so controversial, that you had to give this up because of criticism in the past, and even like these young students to be afraid that how they were going to perform was not going to be perceived in a positive way.
Well, but it should be controversial because art always tells the truth, and people hate to hear that.
I guess so. Well, you know what, being a truth teller, I guess I find that difficult to comprehend. But yes, I get what you're saying.
I mean, another way to look at it is that art is just a tissue of lies. I mean, that's all the truth. It's the lies that you weave are actually a way of expressing the truth.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Yes. You are known for your multifaceted career as a composer, conductor, and author. And so I just have so many thoughts today to explore some of those intersections of your various artistic disciplines, as well as your kind of unique cultural background. But first, you want to just real quickly maybe take a peek or two into a couple of the books that won. Do you want to talk about The Phoenix, or would you rather talk about...
We can talk about a lot of things. Yeah.
Would you rather talk about that, or the Club X, Vampire in the Closet, or you want to talk about both of them just briefly? Give us a little peek into The Phoenix. It's a multi-timeline story that actually, reading it, feels like an opera to me, which obviously...
It feels like an opera, and it's about opera, and mm-hmm. yet it is an opera in its own way. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But basically the premise of it is complete nonsense. the idea is a producer came to me and said, I want you to do a ghost story that has something to do with Italy, but is about Thailand. Mm. That was what she said to me. So I said, okay. And I was thinking for a long time. And I thought, well, there's a Thai myth, which is very similar to the story of the Phoenix. It's about a beautiful princess who is half woman, half bird. She belongs to a race of magical creatures. And she's captured by a hunter and brought to the palace and falls in love with the handsome prince. And so it was very romantic. But then they're plotting to get rid of her, as they always do in these fairy tales, right? The wicked mother-in-law and all that. So, and when the prince has to go off to fight a war, they decide that the only way to have victory is for her to be sacrificed. And they prepare a huge fire and tell her that, you know, for the good of the country, she's just going to have to jump in. And but now, since she's half bird, what's happened is that when she became a human being and fell in love with the prince, her wings and tail had been kept safely in storage. So for some reason, I don't know, they're detachable. I don't know, I guess Velcro or something. So she said, okay, well, I'm happy to do this, but I would like to do one final beautiful dance before I jump into the fire, and I need my wings and tail back. So she puts them on, and she does this wild dance, and leaps into the flames. But of course, she flies away before, and basically is reborn out of the flames before they can consume her. So it's basically a very similar story to the Phoenix,
right,
in an Asian way, right? Mm-hmm. So I had this idea that there's Francesco Cavalli is a well-known Italian composer who basically was the first person to make opera popular way back in the 17th century. And in those days, when people wrote an opera, they would just throw it away afterwards because nobody ever wanted to see the same opera again. It was always like they would always have to compose something new for every time they put one on. So the idea that these were permanent works of art wasn't really in their minds as it would be today. So of the 40 or so operas that he wrote, dozens of them are completely lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had the idea of beginning with a mystery about a lost manuscript of an opera by Cavalli that is found on an archaeological dig in Thailand and appears to have the same story as this Thai myth.
Wow.
Right, so this premise is pretty weird, but somehow I sort of managed to make it all work. And it becomes the story of reincarnation, mm-hmm. where the original singers and the composer have issues that they had to work out 400 years ago and are only working them out today in their present lives. Mm-hmm. And it's all about a fire that consumed the opera house in Venice 400 years ago, which actually happened, though not for the reason that, that's in this story, of course.
Right.
So basically, it's a timeline. It's a multiple timeline, and also I wanted to show that in the 1600s, you know, the city of Ayutthaya in present day Thailand was a major world sort of metropolitan center, and it was very very international, very cosmopolitan. There was all sorts of communication between Europe and Siam, and because China and Japan had basically closed their borders for one reason or another, you remember this will be just after Shogun when they actually cut off all contact with Europe. Mm-hmm. In Japan, for example. So Ayutthaya became the nexus of the European Asian sort of connection for about 100 years. And so I wanted to show that that the culture of that period was so different from what we think of it today, because we often think of culture in Thailand as recently emerging. And it has recently emerged because in the 18th century, there was a huge war with neighboring Burma, and this entire city was razed to the ground, and there was almost nothing left of it. And almost everything that was written or composed or built in about 500 years of that history has disappeared or been lost. You see? Mm. So I wanted to sort of recreate that magical period in history as well.
Right. As you're writing, how does the experience in music influence that in terms maybe of structure or rhythm? Do you hear this story as you're writing, as if you're composing a melody?
Oh, that's a really good question, because I think that's exactly the process.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, people always ask me, well, it's so different to write music and to write a novel or a screenplay or something. But actually, it isn't.
No, it's not.
They're like different languages.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. Music is a different language, not something that's in another universe.
Right.
It's just a different language that you can use to express the same sorts of things. And like every other language, there are things you can say in every language that you can't say in any other language. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true of every language, right? I found that the structures of music are identical to the structure of writing a novel, really.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working in LA, I did a lot of work in the big boom of animation in the 80s. I was writing a lot of scripts for like syndicated shows there. And I even wrote one for the Disney's Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
But I discovered that writing a script for a silly Saturday morning cartoon was exactly the same as a classical sonata form.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, classical sonata form is divided into two halves, and a cartoon, a 20-minute cartoon is divided into two halves with a commercial right in the middle. So the commercial is where, in the sonata form, you have the climax on the in the dominant instead of the tonic, and so you're like, you've got far away from the home key, and the rest of the second half is getting back to the home key.
Right.
It's all the convolutions you go through so in order to get back to the beginning again.
Right.
So I discovered that knowing about music made it very easy to write cartoons.
And I was thinking about opera too. That gives you the opportunity to combine both the writing and the music.
Yeah, well, I'm very lucky that it took me until I was almost 50 years old to discover that opera was really the thing I should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because, now, all the fragmented parts of my life, the music and the writing, they all finally managed to meet somewhere. And I finally found a genre or a métier where I could do all the things that I love to do in one, not just the writing and the music, but also the drama, the stage. You know, it could finally be come together. And that's why although living in Thailand is in many ways much more of a struggle than living in the States, because you're always having to battle for every penny of financing and this of that, you know. I'm sure it's hard for the serious arts anywhere, but it's especially hard here where you're doing something completely new. Mm-hmm. Despite that, it's really satisfying, and it's also satisfying. I find that I'm much more useful to society when I'm here than I was back in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I'm actually affecting more people's lives for real, rather than just entertaining them with a novel for an evening.
Exactly.
I'm hoping that's why I'm here.
No, I understand. Well, you know what? You're there for a reason, obviously. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. Thinking about your fragmented beginnings, where you had all of these different kind of lives that all, as you say, kind of converged together. I'm wondering if, looking back at all of that, is there a particular project, whether in music or writing, that you feel defines your artistic vision?
Gosh, that is so hard to answer. There have been several. Now that I'm slowly getting back into film as well, I may find the answer there. I mean, the script that I submitted to the awards, you know, that's still sort of, that's still being developed right now. I've not done I've only done the trailer for it. I haven't done haven't started doing the actual filming because I'm still trying to convince somebody to pay for it in order to, represent the lost opera. In this dramatic production, I have been composing a fake 17th century Italian opera with Thai musical themes in it, which sounds like really bizarre. And why the hell would you want to do that? But I love it. It's challenging. It's really challenging. And to be true to all those different points of view at the same time.
And I think I remember somewhere we talked about your love of horror, the horror genre, started with your mother.
Well, that's very true, yeah. My dad eventually became an ambassador, and we lived a very jet-setting life and all that. But when I was born, my father was still a student at Oxford, and my mother, he was doing his doctorate at Oxford when I was born. Right? So we were living in a time when they were students and they were struggling, and a life that my sisters, who were born much later, never actually experienced. But one of the things is it was hard for them to afford a babysitter, for example. So the only way that my mother could see movies like Psycho was to have me there too. So I got to see Psycho many, many times because you see, she loved horror films, but she wouldn't watch the film. She would close her eyes. So she wouldn't get to see that much of it. And each time we went, she would see different parts of my eyes were wide open. And it made me who I am today.
I guess so. Your mother is such a lovely and gracious woman. I watched one of your videos where you surprised her with your youth orchestra, I think it was, playing Happy Birthday.
Playing the music from Psycho.
Yeah. And you also wheeled out a birthday cake for her. And she was just a lovely, gracious woman. Oh, so beautiful. Oh, that's so funny. So she had to keep going several times so that she could see the parts she missed.
It's odd about when you see a film when you're that young.
Yes.
There are scenes that you know were in it. But when you watch it much later, you realize that you actually created the scene in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I remembered for decades a scene in which some detective go to the graveyard and try to dig up Norman Bates' mother, and they realize that the tomb is empty. I see this scene with utter vividness, but it's not in the movie.
Mm.
The only thing that's in the movie is when one of the detectives said, well, if Norman Bates' mother is in the house, well, who's buried in that tomb? That's just one line. I constructed the whole scene in my mind and remembered it as if it had really happened.
Oh, my. Your brain is constantly working, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if that's something delusional or just an overactive imagination. Probably both.
Oh, my gosh. What do you do when you're not working on a project? What are some of the things that you love to do to unwind or reconnect with yourself?
Well, I haven't been unwinding much for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in fact, I'm in some ways working myself to death, I guess. But I'm trying to avoid actual death by doing all this work because I have to, there's so many things I have to finish. So about 3 years ago, my adopted son committed suicide, you see, and it was kind of traumatic. And since then, I've been writing huge numbers of books and music and things, and somehow it helps me to deal with it.
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry to hear that. That's
No. It's you shouldn't be sorry. I mean, you know, he had a wonderful life, but unfortunately, he was a schizophrenic.
Mm.
And at a certain point in his life, the world that he imagined, which was more real than the world he was really in to him,
mm-hmm.
He wanted to be there more than he wanted to be in our world. And, you know, he would stop taking his meds and all that because it was blunting his creativity. He was a great painter, and I have hundreds of his paintings all over the house. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I have to make them available to people everywhere so that they can all appreciate it. Because I feel that I've been holding on to them all too long.
Oh, I think that would be really cathartic, you know, to feel that his work is in other people's hands and lives so that they could appreciate him into mm-hmm. perpetuity. Yeah, I think that might be a really healthy thing mm-hmm. to do. Wow.
Well, he was like some street kid who I sort of befriended and who I discovered was this brilliant artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he had many other really fascinating things. When I first met him, he was in his early teens. And the symptoms of his schizophrenia were not showing that clearly.
Mm-hmm.
They only gradually sort of. And I think it's something that comes out in the late teens. You know? But he had had a very traumatic childhood, and he witnessed his stepfather murdering his mother.
Good grief!
As a child,
mm-hmm.
and he was wandering around in Bangkok, sort of doing odd jobs. This is how I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw how brilliant his art was, I realized that I had to sort of do something about it. And so he eventually came to live in my house, and I sent him to Vienna, to the art school there. I would take him to, whenever we went, whenever I had something to do in Europe, he would be there, and he would like be looking at all these great masterpieces, and every time he looked at them, he would analyze all the techniques, and then he'd be able to reproduce them within a few days.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, every technique, he wouldn't copy the painting, but he could reproduce the technique. Later on, his art became more and more dark, you know. I haven't really completely sort of recovered from this.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's one of the reasons I've produced so much work lately.
Yes, yes, yes. And what a beautiful human you are to find this person and recognize the talent within and to nurture that and give him all that you could. And you continue that to this day. Think of all of the students that you're working with in your symphony, that such a great opportunity for them to work with you and know you and all of the inspiration that you're giving them well beyond anything they could have found any place else. So
it's something I just love to do.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Yes.
It's really what I'm living for mostly. I mean, I think that I've been known to have created a number of, good works of various kinds, you know, literary or musical. But I think that what I'm doing with these people is really my most important contribution.
Yes, yes. I agree. You are inspiring. I even watched one of your TEDx talks where you were talking about lightning.
Oh, you talked that? You watched that?
I did watch that, and I just think you were absolutely brilliant. In the short amount of time, not only did we get to know you, but you inspired me. And that whole concept of lightning doesn't just, you know, it never strikes the same place twice. Yes, it does. And to be impassioned by when lightning does strike you. I just thought that was absolutely brilliant and realized how inspiring you are. And another thing I love about you is I love your humor. I mean, you have that whimsical, almost childlike sense of humor that goes along with who you are. Just, you were just a real gem of a human being. I'm just so.
I did forget to grow up. I mean,
I can tell. And I love that about you and feel so honored to have this conversation.
That TEDx talk was very frightening. You know, what happened was that I had prepared this whole talk, and when I got to the podium, there's this little digital timer that tells you how much time you had left.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I only had half the time left that I thought I had when I got there. And I had to, like, do the whole thing on the fly.
You know what? I saw you glance to your right, and I knew you were looking at a clock of some sort, but it did not feel that way. It was seamless and.
I was absolutely scared shitless. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I was terrified. I was terrified the entire time. It might not look like it.
No, it did not come across that way. Oh my gosh. That is so funny. Oh, wow. So many more questions. We might have to do this again, just because I have so much more to ask
We can make it a two-part or something.
We might have to do that. One more question, though. You've been active in so many of the creative fields for decades. What do you think has changed most in the world of arts since you started?
What I can say is that my entire life, I've heard people complaining about how much better it used to be. I want to say that that's simply not true. It wasn't better before. It was just different.
Different, mm-hmm.
And you have to embrace, I mean, people say, well, kids don't have attention span anymore, but or something. They'll say they don't have, you can't write a 1,000-page novel anymore. They'll say things like that. But actually, people are evolving, and they're always going to be different. And there are always going to be different genres of art and you just have to evolve along with it. When you are a young person today and you're in front of a computer, you're balancing like many different strands of information simultaneously. And we didn't get to do that when we were younger, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, and the people of my generation will say, oh, they have no attention span or whatever. But actually, they just have a completely different kind of attention span, where they're trying to hold more than one thing at once,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yep, I get that.
I think. And anyway, one of the things that keeps me from becoming too decrepit is that I keep trying to embrace the newer ways of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm. And that's where that childlike quality comes in, where everything is new and exciting and fascinating. Yep, yep.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that I came back to Thailand 25 years ago, you see, was that I was driving down the Pacific Coast Highway And I had this bizarre urge to enter a monastery and become a monk.
Mm-hmm.
It just out of nowhere, I had this. And in fact, I called my travel agent and booked a flight to Bangkok, like the next day. And I don't know why that happened. But what I did was I became a Buddhist monk for a very short period, because most Thai men do go through that ritual when they're very young, when they're in their 20s. But I had never done anything like that. And I'd never really engaged with huge chunks of my own, my birth culture, you know. And it was very, very eye-opening. And it's one of the reasons I ended up staying here.
Mm.
When we're studying in the Western way of looking at the arts, we always look at it as it's like a ladder. We're developing, we're going upwards, right? So if I'm a novelist, you know, I look a little bit down the ladder. I'm taking something from you know, Hemingway or something. And then Hemingway is looking further down and getting something from Dickens. And Dickens is like going back and pulling something from Jane Austen, let's say, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't directly talk to Jane Austen. I have to go through this whole ladder. And because we tend to be taught that we're developing and that we're improving or bettering ourselves in some way. When I came to Asia and studied meditation and in the monastery, I realized that there's another way of looking at it, where Dickens and Shakespeare and Jane Austen are sitting around in a circle, and you can turn to any of them, and they're exactly as far away from you as each other. So that it's not farther back
mm-hmm.
to reach back to Mozart or to Shakespeare. They're still all there, like at the same time. And the sense that time is circular rather than a line is the big change that happened in my life. And this happened when I was almost 50 years old, this happened.
Well, that was meant to happen for you if that was a sudden impulse that you acted on.
Yeah, it was so weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no explanation for it, but it was important, it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just have to jump off the cliff.
Yes. Yeah, you know what? I don't think people come up with these ideas if they're not meant to be acted on. And so to think that it's an unusual idea, well, maybe it is, but maybe not for you. That's part of your path, really. Interesting. So as we begin to wrap up, anything we missed that you wanted to highlight? I mean, there's a lot we missed, but anything that you wanted to bring up today specifically?
I can tell you that this year, Thailand, the country of Thailand, finally decided that there was some reason that I was here, you know, after sort of overlooking me for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in quick succession, the Ministry of Culture elevated me to the status of national artist. And then last week, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is like the State Department, officially made me a public diplomat. So these two sort of honors like landed on my head almost simultaneously.
Wow.
And so now I actually have to pretend that I'm someone important, which was something I didn't have to do before. So that's something different.
It's not different. You are important. You affect one person in life, you are important. So
this, yeah, but now I have to act like
now you have to behave that way. Okay.
I have to behave, you know. That's very weird. And maybe next time we talk, we could talk about all the different crises of that.
Okay. We'll talk about how that has changed somehow, right?
Right, right.
All right. Well, then, meantime, if you would share any and all contact information where folks can find out more about you, get copies of your books, wherever you want to take us.
The fastest way to it's a sort of entryway would probably be to go to somtao.com.
Okay.
And if you want, you can start your journey into whatever it is I'm doing from there, because from there, there's links to everything else.
Absolutely. That is a very rich website. There's a lot. You can spend a day or longer on your site and find out everything.
And it's completely random, too. I mean, because I do it myself. So
That is very fitting for you, where it's seemingly random, but it all comes together to make sense. How's that?
Well, many luck.
So I hope everyone has enjoyed this conversation. I know I have. SPSamtow, samtow.com. And if you are not intrigued by this conversation today, I don't know what else we can do. Head over to his website, samtow.com. I am so honored that we met and have connected and that you felt comfortable having a conversation with me and sharing you and your world with me and our audience. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been great, almost cathartic, I would say, talking to you. I don't know. I'd rather you than any psychiatrist.
I'll send you my bill afterwards. It is my pleasure to talk with you, and we will do this again. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much. So goodbye to all your listeners, too.